You're listening to People, Places, Planet, the official podcast of the Environmental Law Institute, a nonpartisan, nonprofit research and education institute making law work for people, places, and the planet. If you enjoy the podcast and want to support our work, consider donating at eli.org/donate.
Welcome to this week's episode of People, Places, Planet. I'm your host, Sarah Backer. Every year on April 22nd, Earth Day celebrates the anniversary of the birth of the modern environmental movement in 1970. This movement resulted in many of the United States' foundational environmental laws. In just a few years, Congress created the Environmental Protection Agency and passed major laws like NEPA, the ESA, and the Safe Water Drinking Act, among many others. The Environmental Law Institute was established in December 1969 amidst this burgeoning movement. ELI has since played a pivotal role in shaping the fields of environmental law, policy, and governance, delivering insightful, independent, and research-based analysis to policymakers and the public. In honor of this year's Earth Month, ELI President Jordan Diamond is joining me today to shed light on the history and future of ELI. Welcome, Jordan. It's really great to have you here. It is crazy to realize that ELI was founded before the EPA. Can you tell us more about the founding of ELI?
ELI was indeed founded before EPA. It was really a watershed moment. It's kind of known as the birth of our modern environmental law and framework. Back in 1969, Congress was first looking at the passage of NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. And the same day that it was passed in Congress, ELI was formed. And the fundamental idea was that as we were trying to shape, we the nation, were trying to shape a new framework for environmental governance, it would be great to have one place that served as a clearinghouse for information about how that was going. So there could be one place where you'd publish information, where you would gather information about new laws coming out, new regulations being promulgated, and new commentary that was being written about this burgeoning area of environmental law. So that was the start of what the Environmental Law Institute was. Over the ensuing decades, it grew from that basis. So that foundation of providing a clearinghouse about the state of environmental governance in the United States and around the world, it grew from that beginning to add an educational program, a membership program, research programs, all really founded on this idea of providing insightful, concise, clear information about the state of environmental governance.
So take us back to the founding. Where did it all happen?
So back in 1969, as we were thinking about how nice would it be to have a clearinghouse for information about environmental governance, this idea really crystallized at a meeting held at the Airlie House in Virginia with some leading figures, either already leading or would soon be leading figures in environmental law in the country, who were really leaning into this idea of having a pivotal organization that could really be trusted to provide clear information. And that has continued over the years. ELI has always had a multi-sector board of directors who have represented different experiences that has really lent to ELI's identity as a forum for people to be able to come and really dig into the complexities and intricacies of what makes good governance.
Thanks, Jordan. So how did you get your start at ELI?
So my career took a little bit of an unusual twist for a lawyer. I majored in science in college, and I saw my future to be in a bottom basement windowless lab running experiments that would help produce the information that would save the world. What I realized was that there was a lot of information already out there, and I became somewhat obsessed with the idea of the intersection of science, law, and policy, and how science and, more broadly, information was used in making good decisions. So I eventually went to law school, but always looking at this fundamental question of what is good policy? How do you make good laws? How do you implement them effectively? effectively? How do you make sure that they, on an ongoing basis, are the most effective and appropriate solution? And if you need to change them, what's that cycle? What's the full life cycle of policy? So I went to law school really focused on these policy questions. And when I graduated, I found out about this organization that took a very evidence-based approach. It wasn't a coincidence, I don't believe, that a lot of my fellow attorneys at ELI were also of kind of a background from the sciences. And there was this organization really embracing this idea of evidence-based research, truth-telling in kind of reporting, and really trying to provide nuanced and balanced perspectives on what it meant to strengthen environmental governance. So I came to ELI straight out of law school, and I was here for a number of years as a staff attorney, and then I left. For the better part of a decade, I led a research center at the University of California, Berkeley, at their law school, the Center for the Law, Energy, and Environment. And a few years ago, I was approached about returning to ELI, and I found that in all my years of work and all the organizations that I had partnered with, many of whom I have profound respect for, I was really drawn to coming back to ELI because I think it is increasingly rare to have a forum, to have a space held for unpolarized conversations where you really can have people come to the table, and that's a metaphorical table. They don't have to actually sit around a table, but actually come to the organization and engage in good faith dialogue about some of these really challenging questions that we have before us. We are in a fairly polarized reality today. And ELI works very hard to maintain its nonpartisan stance so that we can have those challenging conversations. We can bring people together who come to the room knowing that they disagree on a topic, but in good faith, they want to come and they want to have a meaningful dialogue to see if they can either better understand or find some new solution or agreement. So I think that's a really valuable role. I don't think it's the only valuable role for people to play right now in the world of strengthening environmental governance, but I do think it's a really valuable one. And it's what drew me back to ELI to really see how we could lean into that space and help craft the solutions for a sustainable future.
Thanks, Jordan. So you already basically answered this question, but I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about what else you think makes ELI stand out.
I already mentioned the idea that I was drawn to of kind of the life cycle of policy. That's another aspect of how ELI is set up that I find really compelling. So we have publications that feature commentary for leading practitioners and experts today. That's looking at kind of the ongoing evolution of the framework. Some of it is very concrete, looking at how a particular provision of a particular law is implemented. Some of it is very high level, thinking of the general arc of how governance evolves over time. So you look at kind of the commentary and ideation that goes on in a publications department. Then you move over to our research department, which within our research and policy division, we partner with organizations across the board trying to work on the ground, often implementation. So sometimes it's the crafting of policies, sometimes it's the implementation of them. And we do have a longstanding focus on implementation at both federal, state, and local levels. And so we partner with folks to really see how do we operationalize these good ideas that have been enshrined. And so the combination of having the on-the-ground work in research, and then we have an entire education division that's working on pulling all of these ideas, pulling all of these different perspectives into a format that's broadly available to practitioners, whether that's someone 4 days out of law school or 4 decades into practice. We try to create a space where you can continue to learn and think about how the field is really moving forward. So for me, the combination of those different capacities, when you then have that overarching umbrella space that we hold for convening these multi-sector, multi-perspective partnerships and dialogues, that's exciting to me, that it's not one part of the cycle that we look at, it's really the full circle.
So as you just said, ELI is really part of the full circle, and ELI has been around for a while and been involved in every aspect of environmental law, policy, and governance. Over the course of its history, ELI has had countless research programs from wetlands to indoor environments and green buildings. So this is a difficult question given the scope of our work and our long history. But can you speak to any important historical milestones that stand out to you?
Sure. Just ask me to pick a favorite child. That's great. So I think there's both an incredibly broad and an overly specific answer to this question. In terms of milestones, this is where we would never take credit for. But really, ELI has been around for over 50 years through the birth and development of the modern environmental law framework, every day working to provide information to figure out how can this framework be most effective? What are things we should be considering? How do we work on implementation, et cetera? So we really do feel like we've been part of that evolution. So we look at the framework today and do feel like we've had, you know, our fingerprints are on that framework. So that's the very high level response. At the overly specific level, some of the things that I do get really excited about, if you were talking to a sibling, a friend who does not work in this field, they would fall asleep when we explain to them, right? When I think about the longstanding work that we have convening managers of total maximum daily load programs, when you start talking about TMDL and specific provisions of the Clean Water Act, that's just not happy hour talk. But we have built up a program that brings people together, the folks that are really responsible for on-the-ground implementation, for innovation in a sector where it is incredibly hard to innovate. And year after year, we work with them to share lessons, to think about next steps, to look at promising practices, and really try and shape that field. So that's just an example of something where you're never going to see a splashy headline written about that, but we really feel like it's meaningful progress on an incredibly challenging, entrenched issue. So you can range from anything from our work generally in water governance to wetlands. We've been working on wetlands protection and management for decades and really trying to figure out how you protect this incredible resource in the face of climate change, how you implement some of the ideas about kind of best practices in wetlands protection. You can move over to air quality and looking at the work that we've done to protect or really illuminate the importance of air quality when you're looking at the built environment, for example, in classrooms. I mean, during the pandemic, we had increasing awareness of just how important it is to protect the air quality in our indoor environments. We've been working on that for many, many years across a wide variety of parameters to make sure that we are, in fact, keeping our children and ourselves safe. So you can kind of go around the work that we do on the domestic side and the long-term commitment that we have to really working on these issues, not going for a short splashy work, but really committing to rolling up our sleeves and trying to see a solution through for however long that takes. On the international side, we do that same kind of long-term work. We've done work on whether you call it the intersection of basically environmental protection and armed conflict or environmental peace building, but this intersection of environmental protection, armed conflict, and democracy. So there's a wide variety, but I think what I'm most proud of is the commitment, the ability to really dig into these issues, really foundational level, to try and see through from beginning to end, how can we develop, socialize, implement, monitor, evaluate, and adapt long-term solutions to challenges that really do affect people's everyday life.
I think that the Total Maximum Daily Load TMDL conference is a really great example of where ELI really shines. And as you said, it's not the most flashy. You never see TMDL in a headline. And I staffed that conference and I had to learn about the intricacies of what does this even mean? But it was wonderful to see state managers who came together from all across the U.S. to really problem solve and think about the health of our waters. So obviously a lot has changed in the 50 plus years since ELI started. And how do you see the work changing, if at all, and what are you most excited about?
If you go back to when we started, the idea of being kind of a clearinghouse for environmental law, that need has shifted a little bit. There's been an evolution. So if any given point in time, if you take a challenge and you're trying to figure out what's the most effective way to tackle it, hopefully that's going to evolve over time. Circumstances change and your approach had changed. So we started as a publishing clearinghouse, and we don't need that in the same way that we did. So over time, we have developed these other divisions and other approaches, whether you're talking about our research division, or if you're talking about our education programs, our membership, et cetera. In terms of today, I think there just continues to be a growing need to have fora where people can come together and really dig into issues and be explicit about the trade-offs involved. That is the very unexciting answer. When I was at UC Berkeley, I would have students frequently ask me, what do you think is the most important challenge? And they're expecting an answer along the lines of climate change and the future of water, et cetera. And every once in a while, I would just be honest that it was really the challenge of making trade-offs transparent and developing processes to make clear how input was incorporated in the ultimate decision-making about how to balance those trade-offs. As a freshman or sophomore in college, that was not an exciting answer to hear, but I continue to believe it. I continue to believe that there aren't easy answers to a lot of the major challenges that we face today. I do believe that we can have a sustainable future that does protect the health and well-being of people around the world. But I also think it's a challenge. And I think that there are going to be trade-offs made in those decisions. So I really think that ELI has a valuable role to play in enabling those conversations in a meaningful way, built on a lot of integrity, built on a 50-year history of every day making decisions to really prioritize transparency, truth-telling, and integrity. And so that's, I think, how our work is changing in terms of our long-term focus. But the core of who we are and the values that we have, I don't think those have changed much at all. And I hope they don't.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Jordan. This was really fantastic to have you here today.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for all of your work on the podcast. And thanks for any of you who managed to stay with us to the very end.
Thanks for listening to People, Places, Planet, the official podcast of the Environmental Law Institute. Our work wouldn't be possible without the support of people like you. If you'd like to learn more about what we do, attend one of our events, or support our work financially, head to eli.org.